5 years ago, Sega was a punchline. That's just how it goes when the track's being built while the train is already in motion. But even that worked okay until recently, Kalinske explained. Now, interactive entertainment has become far more than just an annex to a bigger, broader electronics business. And frankly, I don't miss the endless rows of car stereo speakers and cellular phones. We've broken out to become a whole new category, a whole new culture for that matter. This business resists hard and fast rules. It defies conventional wisdom. Kalinske then described what made the video game industry unique, what made it superbly unpredictable, and what tomorrow might or might not bring. But along this wild roller coaster ride, there was one thing that would not change. Suspension of disbelief. It's always been the fundamental component of diversion, whether that diversion is books, movies, or the theater. Advances in gaming mean we will come to supply that component more effectively than any other medium. The interactive entertainment business is going to allow the Walter Mitty and all of us to finally realize our dreams. We are going to become great football players, race car drivers, or aviators. We are going to move into and occupy new worlds that were formerly only available to us in dreams. There was an elusive poetry to everything Kalinske said that made those in the audience momentarily see things just like he did. But as much as they enjoyed the lyricism of life, what they enjoyed even more were video games. And Kalinske did not fail to deliver, providing new details about the Sega Channel, upcoming Genesis games, and of course, the Sega Saturn. The kind of technology under the hood of every Sega Saturn will deliver the leap forward our new consumers demand. Sega Saturn employs an orchestra of engines. No less than 3 Hitachi 32-bit RISC processors are used for main power, 2 video display processors generate character and gameplay images, and a digital signal processor yields up to 32 voices at CD quality audio. 5 years later, and Kalinske still had no idea what any of that meant. But apparently, the thousands before him did, and loved what he had to say. Maybe the Saturn would be a hit after all. Maybe he hadn't just talked himself into the possibility, but rather convinced himself of what others would see. You'll be hearing a lot from us, and a lot from everybody else, as our business approaches this new level. In advertising, for example, as our industry gears up for its 32-bit launches, we're going to be spending over $100 million on marketing, and believe me, we don't spend that kind of money unless we're confident of success. $100 million. When Kalinske first took over, the marketing budget had been under $5 million. That number, and how it evolved to this point, 1991, $20 million, 1993, $76 million, 1994, $100 million, was enough to make both Sega and Nintendo think that their philosophy had been proven right. Kalinske would say that it took money to make money, that the budget had risen in proportion with success, and what a small price it was to pay for global name recognition. And Peter Main would counter that style couldn't compensate for lack of substance, that the budget had risen as product quality had diminished, and that while Sega might now have a global name, it should think long and hard about what its reputation was. Lastly, I wanted to come back to Yogi Berra, Kalinske said, relishing his last moments on stage. Would he be back next year? 5 years from now? 10? So much of that would depend on what he had to say next. I think when Yogi said fork in the road, he was talking about opportunity. When he sees opportunity, he takes it, and so we do. We're taking all the opportunities we can to make this business soar. And since I began my remarks with an announcement, I may as well finish with another. Yesterday, we started our rollout of Sega Saturn. We're at retail today in 1,800 Toys R Us, Babbage's, software, etc., and electronics boutique stores around the U.S. and Canada. Upon hearing this, the crowd went wild. The next generation was already here? What a wonderful surprise. Kalinske knew this crowd was biased, but he hoped their sentiments would be shared by most, because they certainly weren't shared by the retailers. Following his last meeting with Nakayama, the one where the temperamental tyrant had walked out in the middle of dinner, Kalinske had the unenviable task of informing his team about the new launch plan. And, as always, he delivered the news with a buoyant smile and an excess of can-do spirit. after the fury that followed, when it became clear that this was a command and not a conversation, the only thing left to really decide was the matter of distribution. Because the release had now been moved up by 4 months, there would not be nearly enough product to satisfy retailer demand. Only about 500,000 units would be ready in time, less than a quarter of what had been planned for the launch. This left two options. Give each retailer only a quarter of their order, or give some retailers the full order at the expense of others who would get nothing. Most of the employees were too upset by what had just happened to make rational points, but Bill White stepped up to the plate and made a case for choosing the latter option. The smaller retailers would be furious and make all kinds of threats, but as long as the product was a success, then they would reluctantly forgive. That was just the way they were. He'd seen it a million times at Nintendo. And so, between two terrible choices, this was the route Sega went. This was the strategy deemed best for building momentum, but it would also likely reverse the delicately crafted retailer relationships that Kalinske had worked so hard to build over the past 5 years. Once upon a time, Walmart had refused to carry Sega. Now, Sega would be refusing to stock Walmart. Would this be the ironic ending to all Sega had accomplished, or something that would soon be forgotten on the long road ahead? Saturn will be the steal of the summer at $399, Kalinske said as he neared the end of his speech. We'll have 10 software titles at retail in the next few days, 20 by August. Our total rollout will take the summer to complete, but we're starting today in-store and on primetime television nationwide. Sega is not only here now, it's out there. One last look at the crowd, an image to remember the moment with forever. And that was it. Thank you, Kalinske finished. It's been an honor to speak with you today. Thoughts? Kalinske asked about 15 minutes later as he, Paul Ryo, and Shinobu Toyota took seats in the front row of a large conference room moments before Sony's presentation was set to begin.
I feel better than before, Toyota said, but it is still too early to feel certain.
Kalinske nodded, and then turned to Paul, who appeared to be unmoved by the crowd's reaction to Saturn's early release.
Yeah, they clapped a lot, but what else were they supposed to do?
Ryo said with a shrug. Paul was always the pessimist, and Shinobu was a realist every step of the way. That made Kalinske the optimist, and following his speech, he felt pretty good about that role. These last 2 years had been such a struggle, fighting wars on so many fronts versus Nintendo, Sega of Japan, and Capitol Hill. But all of those stressful moments would be water under the bridge if Saturn could carry the torch that Genesis had been running with for years. Kalinske had been skeptical, and in many ways he still felt that way. But when he thought about the horses in this race, who was really going to beat the boys from Redwood Shores? Nintendo? Project Reality, which had been renamed Ultra 64, wouldn't be out until next year. In the past year, they'd reinvented themselves and had a nice run. But would that really excuse them for making the same mistake, coming to the party late once again? Or would it be Sony, then, who would beat Sega, with a console that they should have been launching together? Supposedly, Sony had the better hardware between the two, but nobody buys a console to display a copy of the technical specifications on the refrigerator. Olufsen had done an incredible job of building a strong game library, and Race had excelled at all the pyrotechnics that went into choreographing a launch, building a team, creating an image, getting into stores, and so on. But the truth was that in the video game world, Sony was an unknown entity. They just didn't have the same reputation as Sega or Nintendo, and that would be a big hurdle to overcome. Could they do it? Absolutely. But Kalinske felt slightly better about his chances after delivering that speech. Until Nintendo was ready to enter the race, it would be Sega versus Sony, and with both systems likely to be similarly priced, it was assumed that Sony's PlayStation would cost $399, the same as the Saturn, then it would be up to the consumer to decide who lived and who died. After a short video at the front of the room sought to explain how Sony was now into the game, Jim Whims, SCEA's VP of Sales, stood at the podium to introduce the day's speaker.
In 1991, Sony established a new division to focus on the burgeoning multimedia marketplace, Whims explained. It was called Sony Electronic Publishing Company, and Michael Schulhoff appointed Olaf Olufsen the head of this operation. He is in charge of Sony Computer Entertainment of America as well as Europe, Sony ImageSoft, and Psygnosis. He also oversees CD operations for Sony's manufacturing business. At the same time, Olaf finds time to write. He's written 3 novels, a collection of short stories, and a play. His latest novel, Absolution, has been published by Random House, and the story doesn't end there. Olaf is also a physicist from Brandeis University. Without any further delay, I'm pleased to introduce to you Olaf Olafsson. Smiling, smiling, but never too much, Olafsson addressed the room. "Thank you very much," he humbly began. "You can tell from the video that we don't represent a conventional video game company. Today, I want to tell you why that might be the best news our industry could possibly receive." Lots of applause and then some more. Maybe Raya was right after all. "First, I want to welcome all of you to our first trade show," Olafsson began. "$5 billion in sales has moved us out of the CES parking lot. It's no coincidence that the introduction of Sony's PlayStation coincides with this development. Now, more than ever, is the time for a definitive technology." But before discussing the future, Olafsson wanted to discuss the 16-bit generation, those video games of yesterday. He talked about what worked, sports and riddle-based puzzles, what did not, attempts at realism, and how this compared to what was available on the personal computer. More, but computer games were less accessible. All of this, combined with so many recent technological and cultural changes, had created a new kind of consumer. "The digital kid," Olafsson explained. "And the digital kid expects technology to be different every single day. He can't remember anything before MTV and the PC. He eats shock rays for breakfast. The internet is his lunch, and if we continue to serve him two-dimensional games, he'll leave the table. So, the question is, how can we become dinner?"
"Maybe we ought to fry them," Kalinske whispered to Ryo and Toyota.
Olafsson described the many ways that Sony could reach this consumer and carve out a piece of the next frontier. There were a lot of reasons to believe it might all work out. Sony clearly understood the market. They had over 400 developers set up with development kits and working on games, and with nearly 2 million systems sold, the PlayStation had surpassed Saturn in Japan. "All of this is great," Olafsson affirmed. "But let me get you the best news of all. Aggressive pricing. Now, some of you might actually want to know what that price is, and since it's a beautiful day here in Los Angeles, I'm going to ask SCEA President Steve Race to join me for a brief presentation." Through the flood of applause, after all, the price was what everyone really cared about most, Race trotted up to the podium. In his hand was a stack of papers, which appeared to be a speech, and on his face was a devilish grin, which had absolutely nothing to do with this presentation. He was looking forward to his speech, and actually knew it well enough to recite it from memory. But whatever blow this might strike on Sega, it wouldn't compare to what he'd just done to Nintendo. In the days leading up to the big event, with anyone and everyone associated with the industry in Los Angeles, Sony, Sega, and Nintendo all hosted grand parties to show the world they had arrived. Race, playing the role of diplomatic class act, sent an invitation to Nintendo's Howard Lincoln, graciously inviting him to attend Sony's event, which would be held on the studio lot. Lincoln, surprised but impressed by Race's attempt to bury the hatchet, responded by sending him an invitation to Nintendo's event, which would be held the night before E3 was set to begin. Upon receiving Nintendo's invitation, however, Race's eyes gleamed with a naughty idea, which led to him and Stretch Anderson making 5,000 copies of the invitation. And so, at this very moment, as Race was set to begin his speech, members of the Sony team were in downtown L.A. handing out the invitation to the weirdest and wackiest people they could find. Race looked at the audience, nodded, and then delivered one of the best speeches of his long, storied, and unpredictable career. $299, he said, and then nodded again and walked away from the podium. That was it. That was all. $299, he had said, and then he'd walked away. Why bother with all the other stuff? That's all they wanted to know anyway. And whatever unsatisfied expectation for words they might be feeling would surely be replaced with shock at this low, low price. As Steve Race sat back down, Tom Kalinske turned to Paul Ryo and delivered a speech of his own. And, like races, the words were few, but just about summed up the situation completely.
"Oh, shit," he said.
Chapter 63. Killer Instinct. In a sharp gray suit, boyishly combed graying hair, and an uncharacteristically cheeky smile, Howard Lincoln stepped in front of a blue podium.
"Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone," he said, greeting an audience of industry players at the historic Los Angeles Theater.
The smile grew larger.
"Welcome to Tinseltown, the city of hopes and dreams, the place where telling the difference between the real world and make-believe is always a challenge. And consequently, there couldn't be a better venue for an industry facing the same kind of challenge. Separating dreams from reality, the contenders from the pretenders, not only for this coming Christmas, but for an entire new generation of video game play."
As Lincoln switched gears, Tom Kalinske, still stinging from the shortest speech he'd ever heard, took a seat in one of the back rows. Kalinske knew that coming to see Nintendo's presentation was unlikely to improve his mood, but for some reason it felt important for him to be there. For the next 90 minutes, he would put down the sword, suppress any sarcastic thoughts, and just observe the men who had once resurrected the industry that everyone was celebrating today. A moment of admiration, a tip of the cap, and then back to wholeheartedly despising Nintendo before the end of the afternoon.
"Now, everyone knows that the video game world is changing," Lincoln said. "But it takes a little investigation to figure out exactly how. So, here are the headlines."
There was something about Howard Lincoln, his stately but affable demeanor perhaps, that made almost anything he said sound like a State of the Union address. For this reason, he was the perfect guy to give a rundown of where the industry stood 10 years after it had been resurrected by Nintendo. He began by acknowledging the downturn of the industry. Since Christmas 1993, the industry had slowed, but it had been slowing faster for some than for others.
"The sector is off by 26% through the first 3 months of the year," he said. "But by far, the biggest part of that hit is being taken by Nintendo."
At this, the audience rippled with laughter, and surprisingly, so did Kalinske. It was true. And of the hundreds of so-called insiders packing the room, he felt like he was the only one who actually knew why. And the fact that the biggest threat to Sega was actually Sega itself, and not just in some metaphorical sense, but in the most pathetically literal way possible, was enough to make him laugh as well. Over the past year, Nintendo's 16-bit sales were actually up 2%, while Sega's had plummeted 43%, falling for 9 straight months in a row.
"Yet despite that downturn, Donkey Kong Country remains one of the biggest selling games of all time, with worldwide sales now in excess of 7.5 million cartridges. So in one sense, I suppose nothing really has changed at all. Great software still sells great."
What was so amazing about Nintendo's newest blockbuster title went beyond the game itself. Despite all the techno-babble about next-generation hardware, polygons, and CPUs, Donkey Kong Country was a reminder that there were always breakthroughs to be made with what existed already. It was a concept that perfectly mirrored Nintendo's recent renaissance. Old dog, new tricks. Tony Harmon was already scouring the globe for new, old things. Gail Tilden was gradually bringing Nintendo power into the internet era, and Shigeru Miyamoto was patiently making new worlds in 64 bits. All of these benefits pointed to the primary advantage that Donkey Kong Country gave Nintendo. More time.
"And there's one last headline that's definitely making news," Lincoln explained. "The revised release date of Nintendo Ultra 64. From the start, we targeted a fall 1995 launch, but the world's only true 64-bit platform will now hit North American and European shelves in April 1996 for reasons that we'll elaborate on in just a minute."
Nintendo was never a company to take its foot off the pedal, but this runaway hit gave them the ability to continue moving at their own pace. With the Super NES making a comeback like no other, and Sega seemingly more interested in the next than the now, Nintendo felt no need to rush the Ultra 64 system. This concept, Lincoln explained, that the name of the game is the game, that it's about hits and not bits, is certainly nothing new to these Nintendo meetings, but we don't just say it. We base our whole business on it, and that is exactly why we're delaying our launch of Ultra 64 in North America and Europe until next April. More time. Time was the most valuable commodity possible in the fast-moving video game world. More time to have software available at launch, more time to implement marketing plans, and more time to let Sony come into the market and start feasting on Sega. In the long run, Sony's entry wouldn't be a good thing for Nintendo, but with similar demographic targets, Sony would inadvertently help Nintendo win the last years of the 16-bit battles. After a video presentation that featured software publishers gushing about the power and possibilities of Ultra 64, Howard Lincoln prepared to hand the afternoon over to Peter Main. But before stepping aside, he left the audience with one final message, which in a way felt like it had been plucked from Kalinske's ill-fated conversation with Nakayama. "First to market doesn't mean much," Lincoln started. "It's what you do, not when you do it. And most of you know the long-term viability of Genesis in America was not related to the time when that platform was launched. It was related to far more important factors." If Lincoln had known Kalinske was there, locking eyes with his competitor likely would have made for the perfect final punctuation mark to the history the two had been writing over these past several years. Unfortunately, the moment was not meant to be, and the two would need to find another way to attach an image to whatever this had been all about. And on a positive note of past, present, and future, Nintendo of America's chairman left the stage to Peter Main. "Howard, you're absolutely right," Main began, moving around the stage with an ease that contrasted with Lincoln's placid stiffness. "I can tell you as I stand here that even without Ultra 64 in this year's holiday picture, there are going to be a lot of happy gamers buying Nintendo products for the balance of this year. And I'm sure that's going to make a lot of folks in this room extremely happy." Even when Main and Lincoln said the same thing, it always sounded different. They were members of the same family but had different ways of relating. One spoke like a lead-by-example father, the other like everyone's favorite uncle. Main ran through the usual gamut of topics, sales, merchandising, promotions, etc., but also had the honor of unveiling a game that seemed to complete Nintendo's transformation. "Fasten your seatbelts, folks, because our commitment to millions of Nintendo players is about to broadside the competition. Strap yourselves in for an assault that's going to nail the 16-bit title for Nintendo this year. Are you ready? Let's rumble!" Sirens blared obnoxiously loud, but that discomfort was soothed by what appeared on the screen next. Images and gameplay from Rare's new game, Killer Instinct, the first fighting game that Nintendo had ever developed. It was like Mortal Kombat, but slightly less grisly, and it made good on Nintendo's pledge from 1 year earlier to stop giving advantages to the competition. The days of being squeaky clean and keeping to themselves were over, but what had replaced them was not necessarily what anyone would have expected. Nintendo was still Nintendo. They hadn't sold out or traded integrity for a quick buck. Rather, they had found a way to do what most iconic companies and characters do so poorly. Evolve. But out from the trenches, Nintendo had come, stronger now than they had ever been, even when they'd had 90% of the market. Survivors, all of them, refocused and recommitted and reinvigorated. Arakawa's long-term philosophy had been vindicated. Main's alchemy of old and new had proved to be the magic elixir Nintendo needed. And Lincoln's gamble 20 years ago to leave his career at a law firm for a roller coaster ride unlike any other had paid off. These three, and all the others who were responsible for slowly but surely propelling Nintendo forward, had warped down a pipe together and come out the other end stronger than before. They were still the same ragtag squad that had beaten impossible odds with the launch in New York. They just happened to look a little different now. Armed with a killer instinct, they stood tall beside Mario and Luigi, ready to fight whoever and whatever might confront them next. Chapter 64. Game Over. 10 months later,
Kalinske sat at his desk and stared out the window. He'd been doing a lot of this lately. Not by choice, but it was a side effect of failure, and in truth, seemed about as productive as anything else going on at Sega. As he had predicted, the Saturn was a flop. Since the surprise launch in May, Sega had sold 800,000 units of hardware, less than half of what Sony's PlayStation had sold, and the PlayStation had been available for only half as long as the Saturn. This dismal experience was accompanied by an untold number of frustrations, but none more grating than the fact that he had seen it coming. Kalinske had tried to work with Sony, and then Silicon Graphics, and even with Sega of Japan for what would have been Sega Saturn. He and his team had redefined the video game industry with the Genesis, then been forced to sit back and watch as it was methodically destroyed by people who should have been on his side. To put it like that made him sound naive. And maybe he had been at times, but if so, then shouldn't he have regrets? Things he would have done differently. People and products he had trusted too much. Maybe the problem had been that he had been fighting the wrong war, all that time believing it was Sega versus Nintendo, when really the more treacherous battles were between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. But without the triumphs of Sega versus Nintendo, there wouldn't even have been an SOA versus SOJ. Sega of America would still be the same 50-person operation that Kalinske had taken over in 1990. He thought back over the years, rewriting history in his head and playing out scenarios, but even then he couldn't find an alternative ending to this story. He knew all the who's and what's and why's, but never could figure out how things could have been different. And that haunting mystery was his ultimate frustration. He could feel history rewriting itself, and it made him sick. Sega was no longer the alternative upstart, but just the new giant ready to fall, the way Nintendo and Atari had before them. Sega CD, 32X, and the Sega Channel would be viewed not as dynamic innovations, but as flops that took Sega's attention away from the oncoming freight train. Kalinske felt he would no longer be perceived as the mastermind of a company that had gone from a 5% market share to 55% in 3 years, but instead thought of as just some guy who had happened to be lucky enough to ride the wave of Sonic and reap the benefits of hawking games full of blood, sex, and violence. He would be remembered as the guy in the right place at the right time who'd benefited from everything Michael Katz had done. Or maybe, and probably even more likely, he wouldn't be remembered at all. History was indeed rewriting itself, and history was cruel. Perhaps Kalinske would have seen some small silver lining if Sega's defeat had meant big things for those he admired most at Sony. That, however, was hardly the case. Although Sony would go on to sell 10 million PlayStation systems by the end of 1996, with more than half of those sales occurring in the United States, most of SCEA's key executives would be fired or let go within a year of the launch. The curious timing of this purge, which included Steve Race, Olaf Olafson, and Michael Schulhoff, would later be questioned in a September 23, 1996 Forbes article titled, "Great Job! You're Fired." Why these men were let go will forever be something that only a select few truly know. But to this day, Steve Race has no problem sharing his own theory, explaining that the way to attain success at Sony was to either get into or come out of a Japanese vagina. Despite the salty language, there would be no hint of bitterness, neither then nor today, and Steve Race would soon forget all about Sony and simply do what he did best. Shrug it off, move on, and find a new company to turn around. And from his quiet office in Redwood Shores, Tom Kalinske couldn't help but feel it was time for him to do the same. "Are you busy?" Fernassier asked, interrupting his thoughts. The sight of a friendly face made Kalinske perk up. "Never for you," he said. "You're one of the good guys. So, take a seat. Tell me what's going on."
"Thank you," she said, her voice still chipper despite the faded light in her eyes.
She'd had that hollow look ever since June 1995, when her son, Troy, the only one of the triplets to survive the pregnancy, passed away 10 days after his birth. The doctors had told her that these things sometimes happen with high-risk pregnancies. It was an absolute tragedy, but not one that could have been avoided. They said the words and presented medical data, but she would always partially blame herself for working through the pregnancy. Unlike Kalinske,
who could never figure out the how of his problem. Fernassie believed that she had figured it out for hers, even though she was repeatedly told there was no reason for her to feel guilty. Still, nothing could ever change the thoughts in that unseeably small part of her mind. She had made the ultimate sacrifice, and would forever have to live with that. "What can I help you with?" Kalinske asked, suddenly hopeful that he might be able to do something productive with his day. "Tom," she said, shaking her head, "I'm just in a real bad spot here."
"In what way?"
Logically, she knew it was time to leave Sega, but emotionally, she just couldn't let go. The choice had become easier to make after Paul Ryo left in June, Tom Abramson resigned in February, and Nakayama had fired Goodby Silverstein and Partners just a few weeks ago. But even with all that, she still couldn't bring herself to do it. She was one of the last remaining dinosaurs, but just couldn't face extinction. That is, unless she was not alone. And she knew Kalinske's contract would be up in June.
"I know that you're legally not allowed to tell me," Fernassie explained. "But if you could give me any sort of indication on whether you're staying at Sega, that would really help a lot. Just to know that you'd be here, and that we could build another team."
"I know what you're asking, but it's hard for me to answer." She was aware that he wasn't allowed to talk about which way he was leaning, because Sega was a publicly traded company in Japan. Still, she had hoped that asking him in person might reveal some sort of answer. She felt kind of bad about putting him in this position, but she just didn't know what else to do. Her job had become almost unbearable. She just couldn't take any more, particularly any interactions with Paul Ryo's replacement. When Ryo had stepped down, his position was filled by someone from Sega of Japan named Makota Kaneshiro, whose best talent, as far as she could tell, was not caring what anyone else had to say. This had really started to wear her down with the release of a game called Nights into Dreams, which was the first non-Sonic game being made by the Sonic development team. The graphics of the game were beautiful, but conceptually it was a tough sell. Inspired by Jungian philosophy, it starred an androgynous fairy who guides a young boy and girl through a colorful but dreary dream world. She protested that the game would have trouble finding an audience in the United States, but he was adamant that Sega of America put all their eggs into this basket. It was by the prestigious Sonic team. It had beautiful graphics, and people in Japan would understand it. She didn't disagree with any of this, but she didn't believe the audience here would connect. But he had little interest in her point of view. Although Fernassier had not been at SOA during the creation of Sonic, she couldn't help but think about how perfectly this situation epitomized the change that had taken place. For the most part, she had made peace with the dynamic, but something Makota had said to her last week wouldn't stop rattling around her head. They'd been discussing plans for the second annual E3 show and strategizing about the best ways to highlight various titles. Long discussions about what went where and which titles got how much attention had led to a meticulously crafted plan. But the following morning, when Makota distributed plans for the show, everything had been changed. The new strategy, unsurprisingly, featured all nights, all day long. She confronted him about this, hoping for at least an explanation, and he told her that she was mistaken. "But everything is completely different," she said.
"No, no. You approve this, Miss Diane," he said. "You have just forgotten."
She shook her head and wanted to let the issue go, but her feet simply wouldn't turn and walk away. She was sick of this happening, over and over, and she was sick of the new but unspoken corporate culture of giving in. What had happened to the Sega that had taught her to take? More important, what had happened to her that she was okay with no longer being that person? "Makota-san," she said, now refusing to budge. "I apologize if I'm speaking out of turn, and I have tremendous respect for all the good work you do, but I feel like I would be doing a disservice to my job if I did not stand here and fight for this." When she finished, Makota-san smiled widely and appeared to finally understand where she was coming from. Maybe this particular situation wouldn't change, nor would the next, but there is now this understanding, and that had to be worth something. And then after a moment, nodding slightly, he replied,
"Miss Diane, you need to learn to be less passionate about your work."
Suddenly, her feet started working again. And as she walked through Sega's increasingly unfamiliar hallways, she decided that she very much needed to speak with Tom Kalinske.
"I'm sorry for asking," Fernassier said to Kalinske. "I shouldn't have put you in that position. It's not right."
"Don't even think twice," he told her. "I'd have done the same."
"Thanks, Tom."
"But even though I can't discuss my contract with you, I can give you some advice if you'd like."
"Yeah, of course. Always."
"Good," he said. "I would just recommend that you don't make your decision dependent on me. I don't mean to imply anything by that one way or another, but you need to do what's best for you. You owe that to yourself." Somehow, with those words, it was as if a curse had been broken, and her logic and emotions were intertwined and functioning once again.
"Thank you,"
Fernassier said, with an assertiveness befitting someone who had accomplished all she had done. Shortly after this, she would go on to work for Paul Ryo, who had recently been named president of New Media at Universal Studios. There, as VP of Marketing and Business Administration, Fernassier would seal a multiple-title contract with Sony to license Spyro and Crash Bandicoot. But before any of that, and coming to terms with life outside of Sega, she thanked Kalinske for everything he had done with a farewell hug. "No, stop, don't go," Kalinske said. "I didn't mean it. I need you to stay."
"All right, all right.
That's all I needed to hear," his wife replied, and then turned around and swam back in his direction. Tom, Karen, and the kids had returned to a beach in Hawaii. Once again, the sun was shining and the children were collecting hermit crabs in a bright yellow bucket. But on this trip, something there was noticeably different. Tom was different. Not long after his conversation with Fernassier, Kalinske called Nakayama to resign. By this point, Kalinske had assumed that his leaving Sega was all but a formality, but Nakayama appeared to be genuinely surprised by this and asked if they could speak in person. The following week, Nakayama flew to Redwood Shores and met Kalinske to further discuss the matter. At first, their time together felt just like the good old days, but eventually that feeling faded, and Kalinske reiterated that it was time for him to look for a new challenge.
"What kind of challenge?" Nakayama asked.
"Something that uses technology to improve education," Kalinske replied. Nakayama's eyes bubbled with questions, until the president of Sega Enterprises blinked, and suddenly they all went away. He then gave Kalinske a strange look, perhaps wistful, and said,
"I understand. Thank you."
And that was that. The end of Tom Kalinske's time at Sega. After several years spent turning nothing into something, only to watch it slowly be turned back into nothing once again, he was going to finally get to make the world a better place to learn. "Hold still," Karen said, trying to climb on her husband's shoulders, but accidentally dunking him in the process.
"This is why I sent you away," Tom exclaimed when he came up for air.
"Okay, I give up," Karen said, floating by his side.
"So now what?"
Tom didn't respond right away. But as he looked at his wife, a smile slowly grew across his face. This was his beautiful Barbie, the mother of his children, and the one who made his world possible. "Anything we want." This time, instead of trying to conceal his dislike for the beach, Tom Kalinske was up for anything. He had learned how to adapt, how to enjoy, and how much better it felt to smile and actually mean it. And finally, after all this time, he was getting to finish the family vacation that had been so strangely interrupted 6 years earlier. Epilogue. All my best. When he returned from Hawaii, Tom Kalinske was pleasantly surprised to find a note waiting for him from his longtime rival at Nintendo.
"Dear Tom, I was saddened to learn that you were leaving Sega. You've done a great job over the last 6 years, both in dramatically increasing Sega's market share, at our expense, and also in representing the video game industry. You were the driving force behind the formation of the IDSA and the E3 show. Neither would have happened without your leadership. Let me wish you the very best of luck in your new venture. All my best. Sincerely,
Howard C. Lincoln, Chairman, Nintendo of America, Inc. The letter was marked personal and confidential, and to this day, remains somewhere safe in Tom Kalinske's home office as a lasting reminder of the epic battle between Sega and Nintendo. This is Fred Berman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation by Blake J. Harris. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2014 by Blake J. Harris. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.